Actually, if you don't mind, today I'd like to talk a little bit about Hanukkah, because again, it ties into something that the Rambam will be talking about. Now, the Pasuk says in the beginning of Bereishis, V'aretz ha'yitzei asayu v'avayu v'chayshech al p'nei kohayim, that the world was confused, the world was empty, or the universe was empty, and the universe was confused, and there was darkness on the face of the depth. Well, that's a pasuk in Bereishis, the beginning of the Torah. So the Gemara tells, the Medrash tells us that that pasuk is meramez to the four Goliaths, and we mentioned this last week. That Tayhu, the emptiness, is a remez to Golus Bavel. And Vayu, confusion, is a remez to the Golus of Persia. And Cheshech is a remez to the Golus of Yavan, because the Greeks conquered the Persians. And Al Pnei Tahayim, the deep, deep waters, is a remez to the Golus of Esav, the Golus of Edom. Now you know we're still in the Golus of Edom because they destroyed the second Beis HaMikdash, and we're still in the Golus of Edom. So you see from this that the concept that Klal Yisrael would have to undergo these four Goliaths until the Geula Shlema was actually something that was built into the fabric of the Bria from the very beginning. In fact, it's predated the Bria Sa'olam. But we see that Golus Yavan is called Cheshech. Right? Golus of Edom is called deep because it's such a long Golus it seems to never end. But Golus Yavan is called Cheshech. So why is Golus Yavan called Cheshech? So the morale is Masbir, that if we look at the persecutions and the things that Klal Yisrael suffers in Golus, we see four things. The first thing that we suffer is persecution and enslavement. Right? The nations persecute us, they enslave us, they hurt us. That's what Bavel did. Bavel made us avadim, Bavel destroyed the Beis HaMikdash, Bavel exiled us from our homes. Right? So that's one type of Golus. The Golus of persecution and slavery. Then there's a second level of Golus, which is genocide. That's when the Umos HaOlam actually try to kill you. The Holocaust. And that occurred during Persia, where Haman wanted to physically destroy the Jewish people. And it didn't make a difference if they were religious or not religious. It was not a hatred for the religion of Judaism. It was not a hatred for Torah per se. Just like Hitler, Yimach Shemo, did not care if somebody was Jewish. In fact, even if you had a Jew who converted to Christianity, in fact, there's a whole story. A woman that the Catholic Church wants to canonize, make a saint, was a Jew who converted, who became a nun, who went to a concentration camp. So in other words, it had nothing to do with what your religion was. Then we come to a third level of Golus. And that's not a Golus where the Goyim persecute you or try to destroy you. But that is a Golus of assimilation, where the Goyim welcome you to become like them and adopt their ways and follow in their way of life. And that's the Golus we would call assimilation, the Golus of Hellenization, because as you know, in Hanukkah, although Antiochus had many, many gezeiros, and of course Antiochus killed Jews, but you have to remember Antiochus killed Jews because the Jews, not actually most Jews did assimilate, but because the few Jews who didn't were unwilling to give up. In other words, Antiochus would have been very happy to give Jews full freedom had they just given up Shmiras HaMitzvahs. So the Golus of Yavan was not really a Golus of the Guf. It was a Golus in which Jews were being enticed or being forced to give up their kesher to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's why the Levush says that there's a chiyuv to have a suda on Purim, and there's no chiyuv to have a suda on Hanukkah. And the Levush says the reason is because Purim, the danger to us was to our bodies, so we thank Hashem by celebrating with our bodies, eating and drinking. Hanukkah, the danger to Klal Yisrael was not the guf. Of course, it became a danger to the guf once we refused to give in. But the real sakana of Hanukkah was a sakana of the nefesh and not a sakana of the guf. So we thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu not by eating and drinking, because there's no chiyuv to have a suda on Hanukkah, but by a spiritual act such as lighting, which represents the light of the Torah and Kedusha that comes into the world. So the Maharal says, this is why the Golus of Yavan is called Cheshech. Because what is Cheshech? Yavan is a very funny Golus. Where did it take place? We're in Eretz Yisrael. Why is it Golus? We're in Eretz Yisrael. We have a Beis HaMikdash. But why is it called a Golus? Because the nature of Cheshech is that when it's dark, you don't see things that are really there. You don't see what is there. And that is the Jews who have become assimilated, who have become Hellenized, they push it, were not margish Kedusha. In other words, it wasn't a galus intrinsically, but it was a galus in terms of not appreciating what you have. You could be in Eretz Yisrael, you could be in Yerushalayim, you could have a Beis HaMikdash, but your heart might be so influenced by the outside that there's no sensitivity, there's no passion, there's no geshmak, there's no she'ifa, there's no desire for ruchnius. That's called, Maral says, the galus of choshech. Because it's like your eyes are blinded. You don't see what's there. But you don't see it. And if you don't see it, or to put it another way, darkness has two things. In darkness, you don't see what's there, and you think you see things that aren't there. In fact, Maral says that's why Erev is the term for night, Erev. Erev is Mu'urev, everything's mixed up. You don't really see things clearly. You think you see that, you don't see that, right? That's Erev. So Memela, that's why it's called the Golus of Chayshech. Because it really wasn't a Golus except for the fact that our eyes were dark. And in fact, you know, we have to remember, the Chashmonaim were a Miyuta de Miyuta. Most of the Jews did not want to fight. Most of the Jews wanted to surrender. In other words, become like the Greeks in terms of philosophy and give up all the religion. The Chashmonaim would be called today the ultra-Orthodox, right? We always read in Israel about the ultra-Orthodox, right? The Haredim, as if they're kind of like a crazy, like as if they're the Taliban, right? The Taliban and the Haredim, right? I mean, the truth is the Chashmonaim were the Haredim, let's say, of their time, in which many, many Jews looked at them as fanatic and not caring. Of course, you know what the irony is? It's very ironical because on one end, you know, the Chashmonaim waged a milchama against the Misyavnim, against Hellenism, against Greek philosophy, against Greek culture. They fought in order that we should be able to keep the mitzvahs and serve Hashem in the Beis HaMikdash. And you know, the Chashmonaim became the Malachim. They established a dynasty for 200 years until the Romans came. And what is the unfortunate irony is that the Malchei Chashmonai themselves eventually became very Hellenistic. And some of the later Malachim actually killed many Chachamim. They actually massacred many of the Chachamim. The Tztukim, which was a movement during the Bayis Sheni that did not believe in the Torah Shebaal Peh. The leaders of the Tztukim were the Malchei Chashmonai. So it's an amazing, amazing thing that the Malchei Chashmonai, or the Malchus, which was established bedavka to overthrow the Misyavnim, the Hellenists, they themselves became Hellenists. It's a very, very unfortunate thing. Of course, the Ramban points out another point. The Ramban points out that eventually Beis Chashmonai was totally wiped out. And the Gemara tells us that anyone who says they are descended from the Chashmonaim, we know that they're really either a liar or they're from the slaves, because the only people that survived, Herod, for example, was a slave, descended from the slaves of the Chashmonaim, an Eved Kanani, a non-Jewish slave. And the Ramban in Chumash does raise the question, why was it so that the Malchei Chashmonai, you know, they started off as the greatest tzaddikim. Matisyo and his sons were the great, great tzaddikim. Why should they be destroyed eventually? And the Ramban says, because they should not have after they, you know, won the war for Klal Yisrael, they should have retired, they should not have made themselves Malachim. And the Ramban gives two reasons why that's so. One reason is because Yaakov Avinu gave a bracha, Lo Yasur Shevet Mi Yehuda, that the scepter of authority shall only belong to the tribe of Yehuda. No other Shevet is allowed to be a Melech over Klal Yisrael. And the Chashmonaim were, of course, Kohanim. And they were not allowed, as it were, in other words, to lead the war, they had to lead the war because no one else was doing it. But once they successfully concluded the war, they should have abdicated, and there should have been a melech for Malchus Beis David. This is one reason the Ramban gives. Then the Ramban gives another reason. And the other reason the Ramban gives is, even if we assume that other Shvatim are allowed to be kings, because, you know, the Ramban has a whole bunch of questions. What about Shaul, who was from Binyamin? And what about the kings of the 10 tribes, right? They were not from Yehuda. So even if we assume other Shvatim are allowed to be kings, a Kohen B'diyuk is not allowed to be a Melech. Very interesting. There's a special Isser for a Kohen or a Levi, because every Kohen is a Levi too, to be a Melech. And the Ramban says, because the same way Kohanim are not supposed to own land in Eretz Yisrael, so too they should not be Melechim. Again, the Ramban seems to be saying that the concept is a Kohen is supposed to be involved as a spiritual teacher for the Jewish people. And when you are involved in day-to-day politics, you know, at that point, the Nisayon of power is very, very corrupting, and therefore a spiritual leader should not be actively involved in political power. That's a very, very interesting idea. Again, we're not getting into controversial areas. You know, some people say there shouldn't be strong religious parties in Eretz Yisrael because there's a Chil Hashem. People see religious parties are doing things to get money, even for good causes. But it gives people the impression that even religious people are just acting for money or for power and not L'shem Shemayim. Again, as you know, most Gedolim have not said that. Most Gedolim have, in fact, encouraged religious parties. So it's interesting, but it is a debate. There are some, there is at least a minority, that say it's not a good thing to have religious parties who are involved in the government. But be it as it may, it is very, very sad what eventually happened to the Malchus Chashmonai. That, number one, the very cause they defeated, they became, and even physically, they were destroyed eventually. Yeah.
The Ramban answers why they were physically destroyed, because they touched something that wasn't theirs.
Right.
It doesn't answer why they changed their ideas all of a sudden.
The answer, the Ramban doesn't answer that. I think maybe it's all about Talia. In other words, it all gets into it. In other words, if the idea is that a Kohen should not be a Melech, the Ramban is suggesting that a Malchus can corrupt even the Tzaddik and cause him to lose his judgment. You know, you see this in the history of many revolutions. In many revolutions, if you study world history, you see that people who overthrow a tyrant often become, the power makes them become tyrannical. Consider, for example, the French Revolution. I don't know if you probably studied in high school. So, this was to overthrow the kings of France, who were very, cruel. So who was the guy who took over France? A fellow named Robespierre. Robespierre was a murderer. He started killing anybody who spoke out against him. Or the Russian Revolution. The Russian Revolution overthrew the Tsar of Russia. So who did you have? You had Lenin and you had Stalin, right? They were not great tzaddikim at all. Now, the American Revolution is an interesting question. The American Revolution might be an exception to that pattern.
But if you were too extreme, or no?
Well, too extreme against the Yavanim,
right, we know that there's an idea of taking something and turning it into Kedusha, so if they were so against it, could it be maybe that's why, or no? Do you remember anything?
Well, it seems to be that the earlier generations were Machshavas total tzaddikim. There's Matisyo and Yehuda, Maccabee, Shimon, Elazar, there were five brothers. They're considered to be great, great tzaddikim. The Ramban calls them Chassidei Elyon, the greatest pious people. But it shows you, there's Bechira. Even the children of tzaddikim can become Rishayim. Hashem does not interfere with Bechira. And this is what happens. This is what happens. A very, very tragic story. And by the way, this might also explain why, the Mishnah does not talk about Hanukkah that much. And one of the Ramazim is that the author of the Mishnah was Rav Yehuda HaNasi, who was a descendant of Hillel, who in turn was a descendant of David HaMelech. And since the Chashmonaim kind of usurped Malchus from David HaMelech, from Malchus based David, therefore Rav Yehuda HaNasi did not want to glorify the Chashmonaim. The Chassam Sofer says that. Idea. Now, be it as it may, therefore, what is Golas Edom? Now, Chanukah is about Golas Yavan. But we're in Golas Edom. What is Golas Edom? First of all, let's ask a very simple question. Why do we call our Golas, ours is the fourth Golas, our Golas is the Golas of Edom, the Golas of Esav. Why is our Golas the Golas of Esav? What exactly does that mean? Well, Chazal traditionally say that the Romans are descended from Esav. Okay, that's fine. But we're not under Roman rule. There's no Roman Empire. Rome is a city in Italy. And the Italians, by the way, are not the ancient Romans anyway. The ancient Romans are gone. There are no such people. So what exactly makes our Golos the Golos of Esav, the Golos of Edom? So there are, you know, three related reasons why we're still considered to be in the Golos of Esav. Yeah.
The Romans' way of getting the Jews to convert away from Judaism, whatever, it's like Muhammad.
Right.
And there's a lot of
assimilation. Right. The only question is, assimilation seems to be identified with Yavin more than Edom, right? That's the thing with Gauls. Yavin was assimilation. But I'll get to it. You have a very good point. Yeah.
Isn't Edom also considered Christian?
Yes, so that's one explanation is true, and that is the Roman Empire, originally it was pagan, originally it was an idolatrous, but eventually, you know, they worshipped idols, but eventually the Roman Empire did become Christian, and since the majority of Jews in the world did live in Christian countries, although the Ibn Ezra says, what about all the Jews who lived in Muslim countries, but the majority of the Jews did live in Christian countries, and Christianity was extremely powerful in terms of all the rules and the laws and, you know, and that. So in effect, we consider Christianity to be the successor of Esav. That's one idea. The other idea is not only Christianity, but the idea that Western civilization generally is based on Rome. For example, the alphabet that we have, the English alphabet, is the Roman alphabet. You see? So a lot of the culture, a lot of the laws, a lot of the architecture did come from Rome, so in effect we could talk about, even in America, we're living in Roman civilization. And the third reason is the simplest reason of all, and that is, you always attribute the whole Golos to the one that started the Golos. Now the Romans destroyed the Bayis Sheni, and since we have not yet regained a third Beis HaMikdash, so in effect we are still suffering the aftershocks of what Rome did. So be it as it may, we are called Golos Edom. But what is the, now this is your point, what is the characteristic of Golos Edom? We identified the characteristic of Golos Babel was servitude and persecution. The characteristic of Golos Paras was genocide, an attempt to physically destroy us. The characteristic of Golos Yavan was to assimilate, to cause us to assimilate and give up Yiddishkeit and give up Torah. Right, those are the three characteristics. So what is the characteristic of Golos Edom? Yeah. Right, that's exactly right. That's what the Maral says. That Golos Edom is not, it's the longest of every Golos. It's the longest. But Golos Edom is not a separate Golos. Golos Edom is an amalgamation and a combination of all three things. Now, you're not going to have necessarily all three things at the same time and in the same place, but that over time and over place, in different times and in different places, you're going to have different aspects. Thus, there were times, and there are places, where Jews are persecuted and enslaved. Okay, betrayed against the hurt. There are places, like the Holocaust, where Jews were physically murdered. And finally, we come to America. In other words, we're in Golos Edom, but what part? In other words, if Golos Edom has parts of Golos Babel, Golos Paras, and Golos Yavan, then the part of the Golos Edom that we have in America is Golos Yavan. Right? Because in America, by and large, our Nisayon is not the Nisayon, for Hashem, it's not the Nisayon of physical persecution. In some places in the world it is, like in Russia. It's not the Nisayon of annihilation, of the Holocaust, of genocide. But the Nisayon of assimilation is very much here. First of all, it's been pointed out, if I take a situation which Baruch Hashem is not anyone here's situation, but the problem of intermarriage, for example. The intermarriage rate in the United States is 50%. That means to say, one out of every two Jews marries a non-Jewish person. That's what happens in America. In small towns where there are not that many Jews around, it might be as high as 70%, 7 out of 10 Jews. It's been well said, if you make a cheshbon, how many millions of Yiddish and neshamas are not Jewish because of intermarriage? How many have been lost to Torah, to Judaism, it is more than the Holocaust. It really is a Holocaust that's silent. In other words, you know, nobody's going to a gas chamber. But we've lost more than 6 million people. However, what you have to understand is you can't just look at other people and say, oh yes, so many Jews are assimilated. Baruch Hashem, you know, we're not assimilated. The truth is, what assimilation means is something that affects every one of us. Not only because Kol Yisrael are ravens, which is true, that if there's any Jew that's not a Shomer Mitzvos, it's my responsibility. That is true. But there's another reason. We ourselves are direct victims of assimilation. Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch once remarked about the Muranos. The Muranos were the Jews in Spain who pretended to be Christians, but they practiced mitzvahs privately. So he said that a frum Jew today, he wrote this, you know, in the 1800s, is like the opposite of a Murano. A Murano was a goy on the outside and a Jew on the inside. And a frum Jew today will often be frum on the outside, but he said, this is a very harsh thing, but somewhat of a goy on the inside. Now, this is a very important mussar. Because a person might be frum, a person might keep all the mitzvahs, but we often go through it superficially, without enthusiasm, without feeling, without using the mitzvahs to become close to Hashem. Now, l'maisa, it is MS, better to do mitzvahs even with feeling than not to do mitzvahs. In other words, a person should never say, oh, I don't feel anything, so I'm not going to do it. Of course, I mean, you do it anyway, that's fine. But we do have to understand that there's a tremendous chisaron when the outside world influences us so much that we no longer get a passion or a geshmak in Avodas Hashem. It doesn't move us, it doesn't excite us. This is the golus of choshech, this is yavan, when what looks out there, whether it be Hellenistic philosophy or art or movies or computer games or whatever it is, or shopping, is just so nice and so exciting and so great, that when we come back to mitzvahs, it just doesn't have that same thing for us. And that is actually the golus of choshech. I think I mentioned, did I mention the Chafetz Chaim talked about a third Holocaust? I may have mentioned it last week. Let me mention it quickly again, and I apologize if I'm repeating. After World War I, when many, many Jews died, the Chafetz Chaim said there will be another Chorban, which will be much worse. In other words, he actually foresaw the Chorban of World War II. In fact, Rav Schwab, that's how he used to say, he knew the Chafetz Chaim when Rav Schwab was very young, that whenever the Chafetz Chaim, between the wars, of course, the Chafetz Chaim died in 33, so he died well before World War II, but whenever he would say, Vnei Yerushalayim, or Rachem, have mercy on Al Yisrael Amecha, he would start crying and sobbing, and Rav Schwab said, what's the matter? Why is he crying? And the family said, oh, he always cries when he says Rachem, because he always says, it's going to be a Chorban that's so awful. So the Chafetz Chaim was a Baal Ruach HaKodesh, and he knew there would be a Holocaust. Right, well, his prophecy was carried out. But then he said something else. But then he said, in the 20s, and after that Holocaust, before Mashiach comes, there'll be a bigger Chorban. A Chorban that's even worse than that. So Rav Chaska Levenstein used to say this over in the 70s. So somebody went over to him and said, Rebbe, are you telling us that the Chafetz Chaim says there's going to be a Chorban that is worse than what happened during World War II? Can such a thing be possible? And Rav Chaska said the following. He said, people misunderstand the Chafetz Chaim. The Chafetz Chaim didn't mean that this third Chorban will be a Chorban of the Guf. That we've had, Baruch Hashem, we've had the worst of. That Chorban will be a Chorban of the Neshama. People will be so confused because they see things happening in the world. People will you know, lack emuna. I mean, again, what can I tell you? I mean, listen, one shouldn't be callous. I mean, you know, thousands of people died. But the truth of the matter is, people are now raising this as if this is the first time that the Chorban ever happened. People saying, oh, I can't believe in God if he allowed the World Trade Center to collapse. I mean, 6 million Jews died in the Holocaust, and you know, tzaddikim, you know, had emunah and they kept on going. But the answer is, that's the kufa of the emes. As the generations get weaker, we begin to question the Ribono Shel Olam. We begin to raise questions. We're confused. In our mitzvahs, we don't have feeling. The Chafetz Chaim said, the Chorban will not be the Chorban of the group. The Chorban will be the Chorban of the Neshama. That's what the Chafetz Chaim meant. Now then Rav Chaskel added a little twist, which is very, very sharp. He said, and the proof that there's a Chorban of the Neshama is that when I told you there wouldn't be another Holocaust, but only a Chorban of the Neshama, you probably sighed a sigh of relief. Baruch Hashem, it won't be the guf, it'll only be the soul. That doesn't bother us. That gufa is part of the Chorban of the Neshama. So this is the goals of Choshech. So the emissary says Chanukah is very nogeya. If Chanukah is a commemoration of the victory over the darkness of Yavam, that's exactly the golos that we're experiencing right now. Right? So Chanukah is the light over darkness. Now again, light is a symbol of many things. Light is a symbol of Torah. Light is a symbol of Kedusha. Light is a symbol of wisdom. And darkness is a symbol of ignorance and persecution and riches. And the miracle of Chanukah is that the light can overpower the darkness. Therefore, that is actually the Golos of Choshech. So, when we light the Chanukah candles, what we are actually praying for is that our own eyes should be enlightened. That we should not be in the Golos of Choshech. Meaning, it's not so much the Golos outside of us, but it's the Golos within us, in which we don't have a geschmack, we don't have a passion in mitzvahs. And this is a staggeringly difficult issue. I mean, you know, you can have all sorts of students in yeshivas at all levels, elementary school, high school, past high school, and people go through the motions, but it's kind of it's a little bit dead, a little bit without a real feeling for what one is doing. And that's a great, great, great tragedy. So when we talk about the Golos of Choshech, it isn't only the Yidden out there who aren't keeping mitzvahs. It isn't only the men and the women that are intermarried, but even the people who are sofrim and so doing mitzvahs. If we're not getting a cheshek in Avodas Hashem, if there's a coldness in Avodas Hashem, we are suffering from the golos of cheshek, which takes away a person's vitality and a person's love, a person's geshmak. Now, but it's a special saying when life is very, very comfortable, because the more used to we are to physical pleasures and materialism, the more blunted we become to ruchnius, right? Just as, because basically physical things give a person instant gratification, and ruchnius is a very slow thing. So if you get addicted to instant gratification, ruchnius is going to have less of a pa'ula. So that's something to think about. Now, one other thing. The Gemara talks about Chanukah, and it mentions there are three different ways of doing the mitzvah. There is the basic mitzvah. There is mahadrin. You can do the mitzvah in a more beautiful way. And then there's the third level, which is highest, and that is called mahadrin min hamahadrin. Okay, so let's go over the three levels. The basic way, which you've never seen anyone do this, but the basic way is you light one candle every night for everybody in your house. In other words, to be yotzei, the basic minimum mitzvah, that would mean, let's assume I have five people in my family, the first night of Chanukah I light one candle, and the eighth night, you know, all the middle days, and the eighth night of Chanukah I light one candle. One candle for everybody. That's all you need to do. That's the basic mitzvah. That's called ner ish ubeso. Every family lights one candle. Now, mahadrin. If you want to do the mitzvah b'mahadrin, meaning you want to do it in a more beautiful way, so then you should light a candle for each member of your family. That's still not what we do, right? In other words, if I have five people in my family, including myself, let's say, so the first night of Chanukah I light five candles, the second night of Chanukah I light five candles, etc., and the eighth night of Chanukah I light five candles. In other words, one candle for each member of the family. That's level two. But then, there is the highest level of all. And the highest level of all is called Mahadrin Min HaMahadrin. You want to do the most beautiful of the most beautiful. So on that we have a Machlokes, Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel. Now this is already familiar to you. Beis Shammai says You start with 8 and you go down. 8, 7, 6, 5, 4. Beis Hillel says you start with 1 and you add a candle every day. So, of course, we, as is true almost every case, when we have an argument between Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel, the halacha follows the view of Beis Hillel. So what you do is we add a candle every night. Now, there's an interesting machlokas we've shown him. If you're doing the highest level, do you incorporate the middle level or not? In other words, like this. The middle level was every member of the family had a candle. Now, let's say I don't want to do the middle level. I want to do the best level. I want to add a candle for every night. Does that mean only one person lights for the family? In other words, you skip level 2? Or does it mean every single member should light for every single night? Now, Svardin, Paskin, that if you do level 3, you don't do level 2. Meaning to say, if you're doing level 3, which is what we do, the best thing, you're adding for every day, only one person lights for the whole family. And the reason they say this is because if the whole point is to know exactly the number of days, if everybody is lighting, you know, people walk by, you know, they see a million candles, they're not going to clearly know. Ashkenazim, however, I don't know if anyone here is Sephardic, but Ashkenazim, however, say that if you follow level 3, that you add a candle for every night, you also follow level 2, and that's why everybody in the house, the custom is, lights the menorah. Now again, people may have different menhagim, but normally this would mean, you know, the women will light as well. Now, husband and wife is a machlokas. Husband and wife, many say, husband and wife are treated as one, so only, you know, one menorah for husband and wife. But for all of the children, sons and daughters, the Rama says the minhag is that they would actually light their own menorahs, but preferably the menorahs should be spaced apart enough, either in different windows, or spaced apart enough so that somebody walking by is not just going to see, you know, a whole bunch of candles, but we'll see, you know, how many days on each menorah. Now, here's the thing. Chanukah is very unusual. It's the only mitzvah where we not only have hedra mitzvah, but we have, you know, another level, mahadrin, min ha-mahadrin. In all other mitzvahs, we talk about, I mean, you sometimes see at a restaurant, you know, mahadrin and mahadrin, but that's an expression they borrowed from Chanukah. Chanukah is very, very special in that not only is there one level of hedra mitzvah, but there's two levels, mahadrin, min ha-mahadrin. Moreover, if you think about it economically, it's much more than the regular law of hedra mitzvah. Now, I'll prove this to you. The regular law of hedra mitzvah has a monetary limit. Let's assume, for example, there are two esrogim that I could buy. One is a kosher esrog, but it's not so beautiful. And the other is a more beautiful esrog. How much extra money must I spend in order to do a mitzvah more beautifully? So the Gemara tells us there's actually a halacha. You don't have to spend more than one third extra for hedra. That would mean, for example, the following. Let me make up a number. Let's assume I could get a kosher esrog for $40. I don't have to spend more than $60, because that'd be the extra 20 would be one third for hedra. Meaning, if the beautiful esrog goes for $100, I don't have to buy it. I could buy for $40. Now, if I want to spend more, I could. But the halacha says for hedra mitzvah, you don't have to add more than a third. Now, think about this for Chanukah. Okay, the clearly following. If the basic mitzvah could be fulfilled with one candle a night, not counting the shamash, that means I could get by with 8 candles for all of Chanukah. If instead I'm adding every night, how many candles am I lighting? I'm lighting 36 candles. So I'm not adding one third for hedra. I am adding, what, 400%. Right? In other words, I'm doing four times, in other words, I could have used 8. And instead I'm using 36, it doesn't come exactly, but it's almost 5 times. So obviously, the hedra of Chanukah is not just a general concept of doing mitzvahs beautifully, but there's some special connection between Chanukah and hedra mitzvah. Yeah? So the question is, what is the connection between Chanukah and hedra mitzvah? So let me give you two answers, then I think from the two answers, we could derive a philosophical lesson. Answer number one is given by the Chidushei HaRim, who was the Rim is Rav Yitzchak Meir. He was the first Ger Rebbe, the founder of Chassidus and Ger, where he says the following. All the Mephorshim ask Akasha, what happened here? The Jews found all the oil was Tameh, and they only found a little bit of tar oil that was enough to last for one day, but Hashem made a nes, and it burned for 8 days. Now here's the question. Why did Hashem have to make a miracle? The halacha is, if you don't have tahor oil, you're allowed to use tamei oil. So who needed the miracle? So the first day they put in tahor oil. When it burns out, they can use tamei oil. This is called a rule, tuma hutra b'tzibur. Tuma hutra b'tzibur means the laws against using tamei things don't apply when it's something that's brought on behalf of the tzibur, on behalf of Klal Yisrael. Meaning, if I as an individual wanted to bring a korban, it couldn't be tamei. But if it's on behalf of the whole tzibur, tuma hutra b'tzibur. So who needed the miracle? Why did Hashem have to do a miracle? Let him use tar oil the first day, and then the next day they'll use tamei oil till they can prepare new oil. So the Chiddush Yerim says, yes, it is true that b'diyevet tuma hutra b'tzibur, but Hashem in His love wanted to give us the possibility of doing a mitzvah in a more beautiful way. And the more beautiful way is to do pure oil. In other words, that's the concept of Hashem shows His love to us by giving us more than we need. We didn't even need the pure oil. But Hashem in His love gave us more than we need. So the Chiddush Yerim says very beautifully, therefore, Chanukah, which is expressing gratitude to Hashem, is Mida Keneged Mida. Was giving us more than He had to give us, because Tuma Hutra B'Tzibur. So how do we thank Hashem? We do more than we have to do, which is Hider Mitzvah. In other words, we could get by with one candle every night, but we do more than we have to do, because the whole nes was Hashem giving us more than we needed. In other words, if Hashem gives us Hider Mitzvah, we give Hashem back Hider Mitzvah. The example that's given is that you show your love for somebody. It's very interesting. You show your love for somebody sometimes by giving them something extra. Meaning to say, if you wanted to give a birthday present to your mother, you wouldn't necessarily think of giving her a mop. Although a mop might be very, very useful. Or buying her a bag of potatoes. Even though, you know, that's very useful. Because things that, you know, you have to have, that doesn't show the same amount of love as something a little extra. So this nes of Chanukah was an extra nes, so to speak. We didn't even need it. Because the halacha would have permitted shemen tameh on the second day. But Hashem shows His love by giving us something more, so we show our love by doing something more for Hashem. That's the answer of the Chiddushei Harim. Now there's a second answer. And again, I'll try to develop the philosophical lessons of this. From a sefer that's called Kehilas Yitzchak. It's not a well-known sefer, but this answer was brought down in a number of svarim. And that is, this focuses on another problem. They're looking for oil, and all the Shemen Zayas became tummy by contact with the dead or whatever. But they find one little jar that is sealed with the seal of the Kohen Gadol that was undisturbed, and that's the one day of oil that they use. Now here's the question. Why would the seal of the Kohen Gadol be on the jar? The Kohen Gadol wasn't in charge of olive oil in the Beis HaMikdash. Answer, this was not the temple's olive oil. This was the Kohen Gadol's private olive oil. Okay. Why does the Kohen Gadol have private olive oil? So this is the whole answer he builds up. So the Mechaber says here, because every single day a Kohen Gadol had to bring a mincha offering of his own in the Beis HaMikdash. He would mix flour and oil, and he would fry it into a pancake, actually 12 pancakes. 6 of those pancakes would be burnt in the Mizbeach in the morning, and 6 of those pancakes would be burnt on the Mizbeach. They weren't eaten, they would be burnt on the Mizbeach at night. The name for that term was Chavitin, Chavitei Kohen Gadol. In fact, the modern Hebrew word chavita for an omelet is actually taken from the Torah. It's not called that in the Torah, but in the Mishnah, it's the mincha of the Kohen Gadol is called chavite kohen. But okay, so far so good. The oil that we found, therefore, was the oil that the Kohen Gadol would use in his daily meal offering on the Mizbeach. But there's a problem with that. the quality of oil that you use for a meal offering is normally not good enough to be used for the menorah. For the menorah, the Torah uses the phrase kasis lamaor. What does kasis mean? You take the oil, and the first few clear drops that come out when you squeeze the olive oil, that's what you use for menorah. It has no sediment, it has no impurities. For the meal offering, what you then do is you grind the olives and there are little pieces of olive there, and that's good enough. So the question is, if what we found was the oil that the Kohen Gadol uses in the mincha, how could that be kosher for the menorah? Menorah requires grade A, and mincha oil is grade B. Answer, it must be that even though the Kohen Gadol could have used grade B, the Kohen Gadol himself did Hidur Mitzvah, and he used a better oil for his mincha than he could have gotten away with. So now, the answer is this. You know why by Hanukkah we fulfill the mitzvah by beautifying it? Because the only reason we had oil in the first place was because some Kohen Gadol did Hidur Mitzvah on his mincha. Because if he would have been content with grade B for his mincha, which he could have done, we literally would have had no oil at all for the menorah, and no miracle could happen. So then the answer, in other words, the miracle came because of the Kohen Gadol's Hidur Mitzvah of using grade A for mincha when he could have used grade B. Had the Kohen Gadol not done Hidur Mitzvah to use grade A instead of grade B, had he used grade B, which would have been kosher for his mincha, we would have had no oil for the menorah at all. So you see, these are two answers. They're both answering the question, why by Hanukkah is there a concept of Hidur Mitzvah that's so strong? But one answer is because Hashem gave us more than we need. The other answer is because the Kohen Gadol did more than he needed. Now, philosophically, there's some very important lessons here, because that really tells us that when we are looking at the Hanukkah candles, we are looking at two different things. And to be a bit poetic, one is a window to the infinite, and the other is a mirror to ourselves. What do I mean? One symbol of light is that it's the light of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That the light of the Neiros Chanukah is the light of the Shekhinah that brings light into the world, that brings bracha into the world, that even in a world that's dark and cruel and confused, the Or of Hashem, if we look at it and we try to find it, will enlighten us and give us warmth and give us comfort. In that way, the light is the light of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that is Meir Es HaOlam. And we say in Davening, HaMeir LiAretz V'LaDarim Aleha Barachamim. Hashem brings light to the world and to all who live in it. That's the idea. Spread down. How many candles do you light on Hanukkah altogether? If you exclude the Shemesh, you light 36 candles. There's a teaching in Kabbalah that, you know, Hashem did not make the sun until the fourth day of creation. And yet, on Yom Rishon, Hashem said, Yehi Or, and there was Or. And there was also daylight on the second day and on the third day. So what gave the daylight on day one, day two, and day three if there was no sun until day four? The answer is, for the first 3 days of creation, it was the direct light of the Shekhinah that gave light to the world. And that light was concealed when Hashem made the sun. Now, so how many hours did the light of the Shekhinah provide light into the world? 36 hours, right? 12 hours a day. 12 hours for day one, 12 hours for day two.
That's assuming that day of
creation. That's correct. It's been well said that the first 3 days of creation might in fact have been a much longer time because there was no sun. That's correct. But this is assuming, I mean, that's one of the answers that is given for the age of the earth problem, you know, how old is the earth, etc. Because the 5762 is from Adam HaRishon. In other words, it doesn't really talk about the length of the days before Adam HaRishon, and certainly before the sun, maybe a day was a million years. Okay, but putting that aside as a speculation, which is possible. But Pashtus, we talk about 24-hour days. So here's the thing. For 36 hours, it was the light of HaKadosh Baruch Hu that enlightened the world. But then that light was hidden. And that is called the Or HaGanos, the hidden light. And the Sfarim say that these 36 Neiros of Hanukkah bring into the world the 36 hours of the Or HaGanos. In other words, in a spiritual way. Of course, obviously, the light that the Hanukkah candle is giving is my light. I lit the match, right? Obviously, physically, it's my light. But the spiritual force of that light is the Gili HaShechina. That is why there are tzaddikim who would spend many hours praying tefillah, davening, by the Hanukkah candles. Because they felt that this was mamish a Gili Shechina. That's why one of the reasons why we try not to do work within a half an hour while the candles are burning, because it is a benefit from the light, right? Unlike Ner Shabbos, why you have a shamish. That's unlike Shabbos candles, where you're supposed to eat by the lights, Hanukkah candles. You're not supposed to read or eat by the lights. That's why you have a shamish or turn on an electric light, because it's kedusha. It's the Shechina. So one aspect of looking at the candles of Hanukkah is, it's a reminder of the light of the Shechina that fills up the earth. Yeah.
Is it also connected with the Tzaddikim? Does some of the light also go up to the Torah of the Tzaddikim?
Yes, that's connected. The idea that there are 36 Tzaddikim in the world is connected to the fact that they are the channelers of Hashem's light into the world in an indirect way through their righteousness and their Masur Tovah. So that's correct. Now that, I would suggest, is what emerges from the Chiddush Yerim's end. In other words, the Chiddush Yerim says, we're celebrating Hanukkah to thank Hashem for giving us more blessing than we needed. So he's looking at the light as HaKadosh Baruch Hu shining into the world. But, and that's what you might call poetically perhaps a window into the infinite. In other words, a glimpse of the Shechina in a spiritual sense. However, there's another aspect of the candles. And that is, we know that a candle also represents a human neshama. The Pasuk says in Mishlei, Ner Hashem Nishmas the word nefesh. For a human soul, nefesh. The nun is ner, the pei is pesila, wick, and the shin is shemen. Now again, let me explain this. The term ner in Chazal does not mean like a wax candle. A ner is an oil lamp. You know these oil lamps, like a receptacle. So what is a human being? We are a receptacle filled with oil and a wick. What do we need to come to life? The flame coming from Hashem. Our job is to be a candle, to accept Hashem's light. So, if on one level, Neros is a symbol of Shechina, the Nair is also a symbol of us. Our radiance, our Kedusha, our potential, again, I can't say the word Tzaddikim, but our potential to become Kadosh. In other words, when you're looking at the light of Hanukkah, you're not just looking at what Hashem gives to the world, but you look at the potential we have to bring light into the world. And that's that second answer. In other words, the celebration of Hanukkah is not the celebration of what Hashem gave us. It was the celebration of the Kohen Gadol, who did more than the minimum to serve Hashem, and that enabled the miracle. In other words, the focus of the miracle is in the world. The person has to have both. The person has, of course, to be aware of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, who is Meir Le'olam. But a person also has to know their own potential and their own goodness and their own greatness. Because if you simply realize how great Hashem is, of course, and you figure Hashem will take care of everything, then a person becomes very passive. You just say, there's all sorts of evil things going on in the world, but it's not my responsibility. HaKadosh Baruch Hu will take care of it. Can't do that. You have to be aware of your greatness and your potential, and therefore your responsibility to be HaKadosh Baruch Hu's partner in being Masak in the world, in one way or the other. The opposite, of course, if a person only thinks of their own greatness and they don't attribute it to the Ribbono Shel Olam, then of course what you have is gaiva, right? Gaiva and arrogance. So a person has to be aware both of what HaKadosh Baruch Hu does into the world, but of a person's own inner greatness. And again, this is very, very difficult, because After all, a person should be humble, a person should be modest, a person should not be a Baal Gaiva. But this is not about Gaiva. Rather, if a person does not recognize their potential in life, then they'll never accomplish what it is Hashem wants them to accomplish. So you have to be honest. A person has to be honest in knowing their chesronos, knowing what they do wrong, knowing what you have to improve on, knowing that we're not perfect. It would be very foolish for a person to say, I'm perfect. But at the same time, a person has to be makir, their godless, and their greatness, and their potential, and their good points. Because if a person is not makir their good points, they will never become that which they're supposed to become. So anava does not mean you don't recognize your milas. You do recognize your milas, but you don't use them to look down at other people, because you know that these are given to you by Hashem. And if we're given a certain talent, we have to use it for Kiddush Hashem and for Avas Yisrael or for whatever the purpose. So this is the idea of Hanukkah. I'm looking at the candles and I'm seeing two things. I'm seeing the Chasdei Hashem in the world, and I'm seeing my own neshama mirrored back to me in terms of its radiance, its light. This is why the beautiful custom that when a child is born, the parents and the mother lights a new Shabbos candle for the child. Why? Because this is what the mother is telling the child. You have added light to the world. You are a new neshama. You are a person that I believe will bring light into this world. And that's why you have your candle. And the Hanukkah candles are the same thing. Now, there are different customs, Rachmanu Litzlan. If a child dies, you continue lighting an extra candle. Some stop, some continue. Some say that even after a neshama leaves the world, it also continues on some level to inspire us or whatever, to bring light into the world. So this is the idea of the double message of the lights of Hanukkah, the Or Hashem and the Or of the Pnimius HaNesham, which also comes from Hashem, but it's a recognition of the godless within a person. This is what Rav Yerucham used to say, Rav Yerucham of Mir, that a person who doesn't know his faults is a fool, shaitan, but a person who doesn't know their greatness is a tragedy. Person who just berates, looks down at themselves, doesn't see what they're capable of becoming. So this is something to keep in mind. Now, you know, there's a famous... but again, the truth of the matter is everything is a combination, meaning to say, HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives blessing into the world, but only because we take the first step. Meaning, if we wouldn't have lit one day of oil, Hashem wouldn't have given us 8 days. See how it works? In other words, so on one hand, a person might say, well, what's the purpose of lighting one day of oil if tomorrow we're going to be out? But what do? You do the most you can, and then Hashem blesses it. And what would be if they wouldn't have done that little bit? There would be nothing at all. You see? So it's a tremendous idea that sometimes you look at doing positive things and you say, oh, what I do would be so little, it can't make any big difference. But what is the lesson of Hanukkah? You do a very little thing, but it was the best you can. And Hashem blesses it beyond your expectation. You probably heard the story, I'll tell you, they tell about a king who built a 1,000-story tower. And he said, if anybody can climb to the top of the tower, they get to marry my daughter. He's doing what he's doing, right? So it was 1,000 stories, and they had to do it in one afternoon. So most people didn't even bother. They said, I can't climb 1,000 stories. There was no elevator, as far as they knew. So one fellow said, I'll do what I can do. So he goes up 10 stories. He's already a little out of breath, 10 stories. 15 stories, 20 stories, 30 stories. Very hard. But how close is he to finishing? 970 stories. I mean, they're laughing. They say, you're an idiot. What are you doing? You're going to go 1,000 stories? I mean, you have 30 stories, and you're already, you know, almost fainting. He said, I'll do what I can do. So he goes up 35, 36, 40. By the 50th story, he is on the verge of collapse, and he goes up that final step, and he just drops. And the landing of the 50th story turns into an elevator, an express elevator, that takes him all the way to the top. So what's the pshat? The person looks at a 1,000-story tower and says, I'm not even going to start. But you don't realize that at some point, HaKadosh Baruch Hu lifts you up. This is true for tshuva, this is true for Avodas Hashem. We look at the challenges we have, and we think about improving ourselves, whatever they might be, and we think they're insurmountable. There's no way. And because there's no way I can do this, we don't bother to start. Without recognizing that a lot of this avoda is like getting to the 50th story on the 1,000 story tower. And that is, Hashem takes over at some point. But Hashem takes over only if you do the most that you can. And that's what Chanukah is. We didn't have enough oil for 8 days. So we might figure, why bother lighting one day? Well, what's the use? I mean, you know, tomorrow we're not going to have anything. But what's the lesson? You do as much as you can do. And then Hashem blesses you. It's like the express elevator. And that's a tremendous lesson in Avodas Hashem. The lighting of Chanukah is such a mashal for how we are misaking ourselves in life. That we do what we can do. And then Hashem blesses. We don't make cheshbonos that this goal is impossible for me. You know, one of the most famous questions that is asked about Chanukah, I'm sure you've heard this question many times, is if they found enough oil to last for one day, and the miracle was only that it burned for 8 days, the miracle is only that it burned for 7 extra days. There was no miracle that it burned the first day. So the holiday of Chanukah ought to be only 7 days, and it shouldn't start the 25th of Kislev, it should start the 26th of Kislev, right? This is a famous question. This is a question of the Beis Yosef. And there are a lot of answers. I mean, actually, at least 500 answers, I know, because there's a Sefer that gives you 500 answers. So there are many, many answers to this question. The Beis Yosef wants to suggest, you know, maybe on the first day of Chanukah, they only poured in 1/8 of the oil. They wanted to save it, and, you know, it burnt the whole day. But that's very difficult, because according to the halakha, you're not allowed to rely on a miracle. So if you have one day of oil, you've got to use it all up for the first day. I mean, you can't make a cheshbon, lechatchila, Hashem will give me a miracle. But I once heard from Rav Lau. Rav Lau is the Ashkenazic chief rabbi in Eretz Israel. And Rav Lau has a very, very amazing story. He was in a concentration camp as a 4 or 5 year old kid with his older brother, who was bar mitzvah. And if the Nazis would have seen a 4 or 5 year old kid in the concentration camp, they would have murdered him. I mean, he couldn't do any work. What did they need him for? So his brother would lug him around in a bag all day, like a bag of potatoes. Like, so the Nazis thought he was just carrying, you know, something around or whatever it is. And Rav Lau said he considers this to be an open miracle that the Nazis didn't look in the bag. Because normally they see somebody lugging around a bag, they would say, what's in it? Because if they would have looked, he certainly would have been found, and then they would have killed him. I mean, imagine this. This, I think, went on for almost a year. It was towards the end of the war. So Rav Lau says, sometimes there's a miracle when people don't look. Maybe the miracle is this. Now, what's the question? What was the miracle of the first day? Maybe the miracle was not that the oil lasted for a day, because that was a miracle. I mean, that's what it should have been. But the miracle was they looked for the oil. They bothered to look. Because sometimes a person is so demoralized, so without energy, after a struggle, that they don't have the cheshek to look. Especially since I mentioned the halakha was, they could have used impure oil. The miracle was, they looked. Because when you, and the miracle is not that they found, because when you look to serve Hashem, you'll always find Hashem. The miracle was not that they found the oil. The miracle is that they looked for the oil. So sometimes, as in the case of the Nazis, the miracle is when they don't look, and sometimes the miracle is that they do look. And that's really such an important lesson of Chanukah, that when you look for Hashem, even if you think it's impossible, Hashem will give you opportunities that you never knew would be shaykh. Now, let me go on to another practice just to finish up the idea. So we've been discussing the symbolic meaning of Heder Mitzvah, for near Chanukah. But let's explain if we can understand the machlokas Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel. Of course, it's not nogeya lahalacha, because we, of course, paskin like Beis Hillel. Just to understand the machlokas, Beis Shammai says, you go down, right? 8, 7, 6, 5, 4. Beis Hillel says, you go up. Now the Gemara says the following explanation. Beis Shammai says you go down because we compare it to the korbanos that are brought on Sukkos. On Sukkos, in the Beis HaMikdash, we brought 70 bulls, parim. And what was the order of the parim? Day 1 was 13, day 2 was 12, day 11 was 10. It went down. Now the question is, well, okay, it goes down, it ends up to 70. So Beis Hillel, just to quote the Gemara, I'll explain the Gemara. Beis Shammai says, the same way the parim of Sukkot go down, the candles of Hanukkah go down. Now that's a very enigmatic statement, is it not? Number one, why do the bowls of Sukkot go down? That's another question. And number two, what is the connection between the bowls of Sukkot and Hanukkah lights? Like, what is Beis Shammai trying to say? Now, Beis Hillel gives a reason that seems to make sense. He just says, Ma'alin Bakodesh. When it comes to Kedusha, we always want to increase and get better instead of going down. So Beis Hillel says, you go up in Kedusha. So we pass him like Beis Hillel, so that's okay. But Beis Hillel seems to be understandable. It's hard to understand what is Beis Shammai's comparison to the Parim of Sukkot. So this is a beautiful explanation in terms of Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel. And that is, we know that if you add up all the Parim that are brought on Sukkot, the Parim of Sukkot add up to 70. Meaning we bring Korbanos Keneged the 70 nations of the world on Sukkot. Now, why do we bring Korbanos against the 70 nations of the world? Because the 70 nations represent forces that want to destroy us. So we bring Korbanos to weaken their power over us. And the reason they go down in number is to signify that as we grow in our mitzvos and our kedusha, the power that the umos will have to destroy us will be weakened, progressively weakened. So the going down in number signifies the kochos of Ra will gradually be diminished. Now again, I want to point out, that doesn't mean there might not be a final upsurge. For example, just as a candle. And if you look at a candle when it goes out, right before the candle goes out, there's a jump in the flame. So too, even things, like the Holocaust, or the more modern World Trade Center, whatever it is, or what happens in Eretz Israel, that doesn't necessarily mean that Ra is becoming stronger. Rather, this could be the last uprising before it does get crushed. So, the Parei Achad represents the weakening of the kochos of evil in the world as we approach Mashiach. So now the Sfas Emes says, if we understand Parei Achad that way, we can now understand the imagery of Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel. And that is, both Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel are looking at the Neros as the neshama of a person. Ner Hashem, Nishmas, Adam. And therefore, by looking at the Hanukkah lights, we learn about how we are masakein our neshama. But Beis Shammai uses the imagery of fire as that which burns and destroys the evil. So Beis Shammai says, if I look at myself and I want to know how I become closer to Hashem, it is by relentlessly focusing on my bad midos and correcting them and changing them one by one by one by one. Therefore, Beis Shammai says, the way the neros should go in terms of your spiritual perfection is, you start off with 8 and you go down, because the way you grow is by burning away the bad, and by burning away the bad, eventually you have less and less bad. And that's the comparison to the bowls of Sukkot. Just like by Sukkot, the evil in the world gets diminished gradually, so too the evil within me gets diminished by getting burnt away. In other words, Beis Shammai is advocating a tshuva that is based on what is called sword midah, confronting the negative within you and burning it away. And therefore what should be happening is you have fewer and fewer things to burn away. And that's why he's comparing it to Sukkot, because Sukkot too, the Purim are diminishing the power of Ra in the world. Beis Hillel, however, says that might be a way of tshuva for the greatest tzaddik. The greatest tzaddik could focus on his Ra and attack it. But for most people, that is not such a good way to do tshuva. And the reason that so is, if we directly confront our chesronos, we often become depressed, we get despairing, and we lose the energy to correct ourselves. So Beis Hillel says, before you confront your chesronos and try to change yourself, you need to build up your strengths
by doing a lot of mitzvahs for which you are good at and which you are naturally inclined to. And therefore, he looks at fire not as that which burns and destroys, but he looks at fire as that which gives light and warmth. In other words, Beis Hillel says, do tshuva not by sur meira first, but asei tov. Because if you strengthen yourself in what you are good at, mitzvah gereres mitzvah, that will give you the koach to overcome that which pulls you down. In other words, this is a concept that sometimes you don't engage the Yetzer Hara face to face. In other words, you don't always take your chisaron and try to change it, but rather you build yourself up where you're strong, and then the Yetzer Hara gets weakened of its own accord. Just like in a dark room, you can't attack the darkness by taking a broom and beating it. You have to attack the darkness by turning on a light. So therefore, now we understand very beautifully the machlokas Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel. The Sfas Emes says, Beis Shammai says that the neiros of Chanukah represent the idea of burning away the ra in the world, and therefore it should go down as you grow. And Beis Hillel is saying, the way we defeat ra is by doing tov, at least on our own individual level. Because if we try to defeat ra directly, it will often overwhelm us and destroy us and make us despairing and depressed. Right, so this is the remez of the Neiros of Chanukah, the Machlokas Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel. It's very interesting. The Arizal writes that although in a Machlokas Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel, the halacha normally follows the view of Beis Hillel, but the Ari writes in Olam Haba, whatever that means exactly, the halacha is going to follow Beis Shammai. What does that mean? What that means is that in some objective sense, but Beis Hillel is for this world, because Beis Hillel comes to a conclusion that is consistent with the weaknesses in human nature. So in a world of imperfect human natures, the halacha follows Beis Hillel. Now this is a very good example. A person who's very, very strong, right? Imagine the way we take criticism, right? In other words, most of us, if somebody would go over and, you know, give a personal criticism to us, we would be hurt, and it would almost be hard to listen, really. It's very, very hard to do that, because, you know, we take it personally, etc. But if somebody's a great, great tzaddik, and their whole goal is just to become a better person, they would actually welcome somebody going over to them and telling them what they did wrong. In fact, they tell the story about the Sfas Emes himself, that the Sfas Emes was the grandson of the Chidushi Arim, but he lost his father at a young age, and he was raised by his grandparents. And the Chidushi Arim used to learn with the Sfas Emes every day. And once the Sfas Emes came late to the shir, so the Chidushi Arim was very strict, and he was yelling at him, giving him musr, and saying, you'll be lazy, you'll never become anything. And the truth is, there was a real emergency why he was late. So the grandmother came into the room and said to the grandfather, why are you yelling? Or why are you upset? Leibish, that's the Sfas Emes' name, Leibish had an emergency. So he then said to his grandson, why didn't you tell me? So look, the Sfas Emes, as an 8-year-old, said, because I so much wanted to hear your criticism. I wanted to hear your musr. I didn't want to tell you. I had an excuse, because I wanted to be criticized. Now, imagine that madrega. You know, maybe I should speak for myself. I don't want to impugn anyone. But the point is here, even if someone has a real taina on us, we'd have to come up with an excuse. And here you had someone who had a bona fide excuse, and he didn't want to use it. So the truth of the matter is, Beis Shammai is right in a purely objective way. We ought to have the courage to know what we're doing wrong and change it. And that's the Olam Haba type of tshuva, the objectively correct tshuva. But Beis Hillel says, when people are weak, and people are defensive, and people are fragile, you can't always confront them with being overwhelmed with their faults. They need to be aware of their godless. And then from their godless, they'll conquer their faults. Okay, so that actually fits the Arizal, that Beis Shammai is the halacha of Olam Haba, and Beis Hillel is the halacha of Olam Hazeh. Okay, wish you all a Frelich HaChanukah. I'll see you, I guess, next week.